other than perhaps those suffering from very severe depression or brain injury, experience curiosity, even though its depth and breadth may differ from one person to another. In truth, a powerful source of curiosity appears in the world every time a new baby is born. Are there any immediate, specific lessons we can learn about curiosity in general from this examination of Leonardo and Feynman? At least one seems to be obvious. The brain mechanisms that produce curiosity are apparently neither the ones that are responsible for superior ability in mathematics, which Leonardo didn't have, nor the ones that are in charge of exceptional artistic talents, which Feynman didn't possess. Rather, a necessary condition for keen curiosity appears to be an information processing ability. To be prodigiously curious about as many topics as Leonardo and Feynman were, he delighted in curiosity about nature, Joan Feynman told me about her brother, requires not only superior cognitive capacity, but also brain mechanisms that assign great value to learning and to acquired knowledge. Those in turn necessarily entail highly efficient processing of data. What then are the contemporary scientific views on the actual nature, agencies, and goals of curiosity? In chapters 4 and 5, I describe a few of the ideas and experiments that have emerged from advances in modern psychology. And in chapter 6, I give a brief account of fascinating initial results from neuroscience. By their very nature, these three chapters are somewhat more technical than the rest of the book, and they incorporate truly exciting recent findings that have significantly advanced our understanding of curiosity. Chapter 4. Curious about curiosity. Information gap. University of North Carolina at Greensboro psychologist Paul Sylvia started one of his articles on curiosity and motivation with this sobering observation. Curiosity is an old concept in the study of human motivation, and like many of psychology's venerable problems, the problem of curiosity seems tractable enough to be intriguing, but too complicated to ever solve. What you may find eye-opening is the fact that Sylvia's comment was made as recently as 2012. In this light, it should probably come as no surprise that about two decades earlier, University of South Florida psychologists Charles Spielberger and Laura Starr had made a similar remark. Although many investigators have devoted their efforts to research on curiosity and exploratory behavior, the literature continues to be characterized by diverse theoretical views and contradictory empirical findings. Indeed, the fact that the motivational nature of curiosity has spawned psychological theories that point in different directions suggests that this is a very fluid area of research in which we still have some way to go before a comprehensive, compelling theory of curiosity will emerge. In fact, curiosity is often bundled together with other psychological elements that characterize human consciousness, and human consciousness, as cognitive scientist and philosopher Daniel Dennett puts it, is just about the last surviving mystery. What Dennett means is simply that whereas we now know at least how to think about such complex concepts as space, time, and the laws of nature, even though we still don't have a definitive theory for all of them, consciousness stands alone today as a topic that often leaves even the most sophisticated thinkers tongue-tied and confused. The problem of fully grasping the nature of curiosity is somewhat compounded by the fact that there isn't even a single definition of the term curiosity that is accepted by all. Consequently, phenomena as diverse as the drive to conduct deep ocean exploration and the emotion evoked by watching Jeopardy on TV are often grouped under the same curiosity umbrella. In addition, since neuroscience is a considerably younger discipline than psychology, the precise neural underpinnings of curiosity are even less well understood than the psychological ones. These difficulties notwithstanding, thanks to recent progress in cognitive psychology and the maturation of neuroimaging techniques, Researchers have made and are continuing to make great strides both in their investigations into what stimulates curiosity and the mechanisms it comprises, and in identifying the precise regions in the brain that are activated in the arousal and relief of curiosity. In order not to get too bogged down with details right from the outset, I shall initially adopt as the definition of curiosity the rather broad formulation suggested by University of Rochester cognitive scientists Celeste Kidd and Benjamin Hayden. Curiosity is a drive state for information. Even more simply, curiosity is the desire to know why, how, or who. We shall have to use a sharper, more discerning definition later, especially in relation to cognitive and neuroscientific investigations. Before probing more deeply into the scientific strands of thought on the essence of curiosity, I want to start with the, at least seemingly, much simpler question, what are people normally curious about in their everyday lives? As a preliminary stab at answering this question, I conducted a small, unscientific poll among a few of my work colleagues. I asked them to describe what piqued their curiosity most, outside of their professional interests. I said I wasn't particularly interested in whether they had once succumbed to the temptation to glance at an open diary. Rather, I wanted to hear about those themes to which they had actually devoted some time, and by which they had been sufficiently captivated to delve into, either through reading and conversations, or by web browsing and watching TV programs. I found the results quite fascinating, in that of the 16 interviewees, no two persons named the same topic. One person was curious about the nature versus nurture conundrum, identifying whether heredity or the environment is the main factor that directs and influences people's development and personality. Only two other people mentioned topics somewhat related to this subject. One person was curious about the precise processes in the brain through which children learn. Another was curious to know whether there are clearly discernible physiological differences between the brains of open-minded people and the brains of those individuals who are extremely rigid in their views. As we shall see, both topics are actually directly linked to curiosity, since one of curiosity's main goals is believed to be maximizing learning. And curiosity is also one of several facets of openness. In some sense, therefore, both of these colleagues were curious about curiosity. Two people were curious about some aspect of sports. One would have liked to know the true extent of doping in various branches of sports, and the other was captivated by the science behind sports. Two people were curious about topics related to the Earth. One about the geological history of our planet, the other about the largely unexplored world at the bottom of the ocean. Two of the subjects involved history. One person's curiosity was focused on World War II, and another's on how we got to where we are today from the time of the Industrial Revolution. The remaining colleagues had their own unique objects of curiosity: antiques, wines, data characterizing people's lives, colors and shapes in interior design, airlines, colony collapse disorder of bees, and the chronicle of achievements of prominent social activists. Even this unsystematic experiment revealed some interesting points. First, a few of the topics reflected what one might call personal hobbies, that is, interests undertaken primarily for pleasure or relaxation. These included interior design, wines, and antiques. Other subjects seem to have aroused curiosity because they are surprising or unexpected. For example, the phenomenon of colony collapse disorder, the abrupt disappearance of worker bees from honeybee colonies around the globe, and the stunning revelations about widespread doping in cycling, baseball, and even tennis. Another distinctive feature that appeared to be an originator of curiosity was what MIT cognitive scientist Laura Schultz refers to as confounded evidence. In other words, situations that are so ambiguous that one cannot decide between different, competing hypotheses or ideas, or where the existing information just isn't sufficient to draw solid conclusions. Themes that fell into this category included the nature versus nurture dilemma, and the question of whether open-mindedness and intolerance manifest themselves through something observable in the human brain. What is most of the U.S. population interested in? For the answer, I examined the most viewed articles on Wikipedia in the years 2012, 2013, 2014, and 2015. Topping the list were tech companies and their social media or information products, such as Facebook, Google, YouTube, Instagram, Wiki. Certain blockbuster movies and TV programs, for example, The Hunger Games, Breaking Bad, The Avengers, The Dark Knight Rises, Star Wars The Force Awakens. Deaths of famous people, Neil Armstrong, Whitney Houston, Dick Clark, Margaret Thatcher, Nelson Mandela, Robin Williams, Oliver Sacks, Yogi Berra, the lives of celebrities in general, Kate Middleton, Kim Kardashian, Miley Cyrus, and sports events such as the 2014 FIFA World Cup. This unsophisticated internet survey hinted at a few additional elements that can induce curiosity. For instance, the interest in new technology products reflected novelty seeking and a drive to learn. The fascination with the lives and deaths of celebrities can perhaps be broadly categorized as gossip, and gossip, as we shall see in Chapter 7, may have played a key role in our evolutionary success. I should note, though, that the Wikipedia list is most likely dominated by the interests of a relatively younger demographic. For example, as of December 2015, 48.5% of U.S. internet addicts who used Instagram were between the ages of 18 and 34, and only 5.5% were 65 or older. While the extremely diverse nature of the lists of topics that trigger curiosity may look overwhelming at first, psychologists have devised ingenious ways to group such subjects into a smaller number of categories. In particular, recall that psychologist Daniel Berline mapped curiosity onto a two-dimensional grid. On one axis, curiosity reached from the specific, the desire or need for distinct information, to the diversive, the ceaseless seeking of stimulation to ward off boredom. The other axis ran from perceptual curiosity, aroused by surprising, ambiguous, or novel stimuli, to epistemic curiosity, the genuine yearning for new knowledge. Berline's insightful classification, while not unique, is useful in the sense that it allows us to locate any particular curiosity on the grid. For instance, one could argue that the curiosity sparked by confounded evidence, or equivalently, the curiosity that typically motivates basic scientific research, belongs in the epistemic-specific quadrant of the map. That is, we search for some information that will help us decide among alternatives or will guide us in untangling a confusing mess. Ultimately, scientists often conduct their investigations with the goal of finding the answers to particular clearly defined questions. On the other hand, the curiosity that is driving continuous browsing on Twitter, following up on tabloid headlines, or the desire to check for new text messages more likely maps onto the diversive perceptual region. In other words, people are searching for some distraction, thrill, or surprise. As we shall see in Chapter 6, the distinction between perceptual, aroused by novelty, and epistemic, the desire for knowledge, curiosity in particular, may manifest itself in different brain regions that are activated by curiosity. Berline can be credited with having put the concept of curiosity on the psychological agenda in a big way. A simple comparison of psychological abstracts prior to 1960, the year in which Berline's book Conflict, Arousal, and Curiosity appeared, with a more recent volume, demonstrates his impact on this research field. Later in life, Berline, who was also a competent pianist and a huge art lover, also became curious about aesthetics, specifically about the question of what it is that makes certain artworks attractive. In spite of being a rather reserved and shy person, who, as his friends testified, used to stand quietly in a corner nursing a gin and tonic at social functions of psychological organizations, his influence, both in the laboratory and on the psychological community at large, was unmistakable. Berline made another seminal and enduring contribution to the study of curiosity, with the identification of a class of distinct factors that, in his view, determined whether or not something was interesting and worthy of exploration. These factors are novelty, complexity, uncertainty, and conflict. Novelty alludes to topics or phenomena that can't easily be categorized within previous experiences and expectations. For example, the discovery of a new biological species or the first appearance of a smartphone. Complexity identifies those objects or events that do not follow regular patterns, but rather contain a variety of loosely integrated components. This concept is used, for instance, to describe events in economics, where many people and companies attempt to make sense of market behavior based on whatever information they possess, and where they collectively create outcomes to which they must react rapidly. Uncertainty, to which I shall return in more detail in the next section, characterizes situations in which any number of alternative results is possible. Anyone who follows weather forecasts is familiar with uncertainty. Despite sophisticated computer models and newfangled technology, meteorologists still occasionally get it wrong. Finally, conflict describes circumstances in which new information is incompatible with existing knowledge or biases, as with the discovery that there actually were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or where it isn't clear whether one should respond by taking action or by avoiding the activity altogether. When summarizing Berline's work, psychologist Vladimir Konechny appreciatively wrote in his 1978 obituary that Berline wanted to know why organisms display curiosity and explore their environment, why they seek knowledge and information, why they look at paintings or listen to music, what directs their train of thought. I find it interesting that even the naive and subjective exercise of polling my work colleagues identified at least two elements that drive curiosity: surprise, which triggers perceptual curiosity, and confounded evidence, which gives rise to a craving for knowledge or epistemic curiosity. What, then, are the main psychological schools of thought about the causes and mental processes involved in curiosity? We shall discuss neuroscience in Chapter 6. Mind the gap. Like many other trends in modern psychology, a few of the earliest ideas about curiosity were inspired by the work of philosopher and psychologist William James. Presciently, and using present-day cognitive terms, James proposed in the late 19th century that what he called metaphysical wonder, or scientific curiosity, was a response of the philosophic brain to an inconsistency or a gap in knowledge, just as the musical brain responds to a discord in what it hears. He further suggested that curiosity represents the desire to learn more about those things we don't understand. A century later, Carnegie Mellon psychologist George Lowenstein put forward a contemporary theoretical version of these concepts, an extremely influential framework that has become known as the information gap theory. The basic idea behind this scenario for the explanation of curiosity is simple, once it is pointed out. It commences with the reasonable assumption that individuals have some preconceived notions about the world surrounding them, or for that matter, about any given topic, and that we seek coherence. When we encounter some facts that appear to be incompatible with our prior actual or imagined knowledge, with our internal predictive model, or with our prejudices, a gap is generated. We experience this gap as an aversive state, an unpleasant sensation. Consequently, we are driven to investigate and seek new insights that will reduce the uncertainty and feeling of ignorance. According to this view, curiosity and the ensuing exploratory behavior are not goals in themselves. Rather, they are the means through which we attempt to reduce the uncomfortable sensation caused by uncertainty and confusion. In Lowenstein's own words, curiosity is a cognitive-induced deprivation that arises from the perception of a gap in knowledge and understanding. Simply put, in keeping with the information gap theory, curiosity resembles scratching a mental or intellectual itch. Naturally, the information gap theory identifies uncertainty, a perceived disparity between the existing and the desired informational condition, as the chief cause of curiosity. Indeed, being uncertain about possible outcomes at life's challenging junctions can be discomforting. Both in Lowenstein's work and in the context of similar ideas previously expressed by Berline, the concept of uncertainty was borrowed from traditional measures of information theory. In simple terms, information theory articulates that all else being equal, situations with a larger number of alternatives or possible results produce a higher uncertainty. For example, if all women's soccer teams are not dramatically different from one another in strength, it will be harder to predict which team will win the World Cup at the beginning of the games than it will be when only two teams are left. Likewise, the uncertainty is larger for potential outcomes of nearly equal probability. If two teams are of comparable skill and motivation, it is more difficult to predict which one will win than if one is decisively superior to the other. Anyone who watched the NBA Finals in 2016 between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors can testify to the truth of this statement. A body of research in psychology in the past few decades and in neuroscience in recent years supports at least some aspects of the information gap theory. For instance, studies have demonstrated that when people are presented with unusual, surprising, or complex objects or situations, those circumstances elicit significantly enhanced attention. Some of those investigations have shown that the desire for inspection and inquiry lasted only until people perceived that they had resolved the uncertainty by acquiring new information. Lowenstein further argues that the magnitude of the gap that people estimate depends on their subjective judgment of the depth of their knowledge and their ability to retrieve information. This is what cognitive scientists refer to as the feeling of knowing. Lowenstein conjectured that someone with a more intense feeling of knowing may deem a certain knowledge gap surmountable where others may not. This perceived capability to overcome a knowledge gap, in turn, was assumed to enhance curiosity, as individuals would feel that with not too much effort they could remove the uncertainty and escape the unpleasant state of anxiety. For example, if someone thinks she knows the names of almost all the actors in a certain movie, she might put extra effort into trying to remember one missing name than if she has no idea who is in the cast. Lowenstein's information gap thesis provides a very interesting perspective on the nature of at least some forms of curiosity. In particular, it is easy to see how specific curiosity, the urge to acquire a discrete piece of information, can be aroused by an information gap. In any murder mystery, be it a novel by Agatha Christie, Dan Brown, or Robert Galbraith, the pen name of J.K. Rowling, or a film by Alfred Hitchcock, we are curious to know who committed the murder, and sometimes also why and how. Similarly, if your best friend comes to you and says, "I have something extremely important to tell you." "Oh, you know what, never mind." This could be truly exasperating. It is straightforward in such cases to identify the information gap that needs to be filled, and curiosity arises because we are fully aware of the precise difference between what we know and what we would like to know. An information gap is also the reason overhearing half of conversation, as when someone next to you is speaking on his or her cell phone, is more curiosity-inducing and more distracting than hearing an entire conversation. In a study by Cornell psychologists, the researchers discovered that listening to such half-a-logs results in poorer performance on a variety of cognitive tasks that require attention. When we are missing the other half of the story, we cannot predict the flow of the conversation, and therefore we find it virtually impossible to tune out the half-a-logs. The lead author on the Cornell study, Lauren Emberson, came up with the idea to examine this phenomenon when she was riding a bus to the university for 45 minutes every day. "I really felt like I couldn't do anything else when someone was on a cell phone," she explained. This may explain in part why you see so many people wearing headphones on trains and buses. The producers of serial TV dramas and soap operas and the authors of thrillers understand the curiosity-arousing powers of information gaps. They attempt to turn the ending of every episode or chapter into a cliffhanger that leaves the audience or readership in suspense. You'll notice that according to the information gap scenario, curiosity seeks to satisfy a need that at least superficially appears to be not too dissimilar from physical needs, such as those for food, sleep, and the disposal of bodily waste. However, several researchers have pointed out important differences between simple biological urges and curiosity. For example, biological drives such as hunger are typically prompted by clear somatic signals, such as a rumbling belly or stomach pangs. The realization of an information gap, on the other hand, requires a knowledge-based mechanism. To recognize and evaluate the gap, individuals need to actually know something about both their initial information state and their goal or aspired state. You cannot be too curious about the physical nature of dark energy, for instance, without first knowing something about this mysterious form of energy, which permeates all space and propels the cosmic expansion to speed up. This raises the first inherent potential difficulty with the information gap scenario, if viewed as a comprehensive theory of curiosity in all of its types and forms. In some cases, it is not easy to see how individuals may be able to properly evaluate their starting or desired levels of uncertainty, given that one never has a complete knowledge of the broader context. It is very common in scientific research, for instance, that the results of one experiment, observation, or theoretical concept raise new questions that had not been anticipated. By way of illustration, Darwin's theory of evolution by means of natural selection brought the question of the actual origin of life, a topic Darwin had not touched upon, to center stage. Similarly, the recent discovery that there exist billions of planets orbiting stars other than the Sun has turned the attempts to answer the question, "Are we alone in the universe?" into an obsession for many astronomers. The puzzle is, therefore, how does the brain manage to be conscious of and properly define information gaps? How do we assess the extent of our own knowledge and determine how much we do not know? This problem points to a latent, clear distinction between biologically determined appetites, which can be felt by everybody in certain circumstances, and curiosity, which may differ from one individual to the next, even under precisely the same conditions. In addition, while specific curiosity may be satisfied if a certain desired piece of information is provided, curiosity in general, in particular epistemic curiosity and the tendency to explore, are actually never truly satiated. Psychologists have also spotted a few additional problems with the information gap theory, again, if it is taken to be an all-encompassing theory of curiosity. First, it regards curiosity as always being associated with a negative, aversive, unpleasant state. But many experiments on exploratory behavior point to novelty and variety as often being perceived as positive and enjoyable experiences that fuel excitement and attentiveness. In a study with students in 7th and 11th grades, for example, the students identified as curious reported their involvement in school activities as more satisfying and more valuable, rather than being disagreeable. Even uncertainty, the key ingredient driving the information gap model, does not always have a negative effect, or no one would read murder mysteries or engage in any whimsical activity. While it is undoubtedly true that uncertainty can be discomforting, for example, when one is awaiting the results of a medical test that could confirm or eliminate suspicion of a serious illness, uncertainty about the source of a positive effect could lead to prolonged pleasure. This last fact was demonstrated in 2005 in an interesting experiment by psychologists Timothy Wilson and Daniel Gilbert and their collaborators. Each participant in the test believed that he or she was one of six students, three women and three men, at different universities, participating in an experiment concerned with impressions formed through the Internet. They were told that each one of the six would evaluate the students of the opposite sex, choose one as their best potential friend, and write a paragraph explaining their selection. Every participant was then informed that all three of the opposite sex students, who were, in fact, fictitious, had selected him or her as best friend. The participants were divided into two groups. Those in the certainty group were told which of the three opposite sex members, supposedly, had written which flattering explanation. In the uncertainty group, this information was not provided. Can you guess which group remained happy for a longer period of time? All the participants were pleased to receive the positive feedback about having been selected as a best friend. However, those in the uncertainty group remained significantly more buoyant 15 minutes later. In other words, if people know that a certain event is positive, they enjoy being curious about it. This is partly why, for example, some expecting parents prefer not to know the gender of the fetus, why the first rush of a love affair is immensely pleasurable, and why some people who record the Wimbledon tennis tournament's final match don't want to know the result before they watch the match. They all enjoy the uncertainty. Only if people are uncertain whether the event will be positive or negative, will they be admitted to a school of their choice, will a certain medical treatment help, is the uncertainty regarded as negative. Fascinatingly, the romantic poet John Keats introduced the term negative capability to argue that the ability to tolerate and even embrace uncertainty and the willingness to let the unknown remain mysterious are essential qualities for poetic and literary achievement. To Keats, "With a great poet, the sense of beauty overcomes every other consideration, or rather obliterates all consideration." His concept of negative capability has influenced the ideas of a few 20th century philosophers, including Roberto Unger, who applied it in social contexts, and John Dewey, who incorporated it into his philosophical tradition of pragmatism. Recall that even Feynman, who was not a poet but a scientist, and who generally argued that deciphering phenomena only adds to their beauty, also once said, "I don't feel frightened by not knowing, by being lost in a mysterious universe without any purpose." A second, related problem that the information gap theory raises is this. Given that people do occasionally become proactively curious, one could metaphorically invoke a version of Newton's first law of motion. A body at rest stays at rest. To wonder why anybody would become curious if that is tantamount to asking for an unpleasant sensation. Yet it is very often the case that curiosity about one subject leads to the urge to explore more topics. After all, the most basic characteristic of curiosity is the desire to pose a question, thereby risking generating even more uncertainty, which in the context of the information gap model is perceived as distressing. The third problem has to do with the presumed universality of the information gap theory. That is, even if the basic premise of the theory is correct, at the very least it appears to be an oversimplification, especially when it comes to different types of curiosity. The impression is that there are far too many potential triggers of curiosity for us to be able to collapse them all into just one variable, uncertainty, without some loss of important information in the process. For example, can one truly argue that being curious about the precise nature of gravitational waves, about why music evokes powerful emotions, about how magicians perform their tricks, about what your lunch companion is thinking, about the role of dreams, and about Kim Kardashian's latest Instagrams are all manifestations of a simple information gap? As we shall soon see, current thinking is that while the information gap scenario offers an excellent mechanism for certain types of curiosity, curiosity in its most general form comprises a family of mechanisms. Before we discuss other theories, however, There is an additional characteristic of curiosity that requires some explanation, irrespective of what the correct integrative theory, if one exists, may be. Known unknowns. In Plato's Socratic dialogue, Meno, a young and well-born student named Meno attempts to challenge the great Socrates by purporting to demonstrate that inquiring into the unknown is actually impossible. "And how will you inquire, Socrates," Meno asks, "into something when you don't know at all what it is? Which of the things that you don't know will you propose as the object of your inquiry?" Meno points here to the famous unknown unknowns problem, things we don't know that we don't know. The phrase unknown unknowns was coined by U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld during a news briefing held in February 2002 concerning a possible Iraq war. When commenting on the lack of evidence linking Iraq with supplying weapons of mass destruction to terrorist organizations, Rumsfeld told reporters, "Reports that say something hasn't happened are always interesting to me, because as we know, there are known knowns, there are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns, that is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know." In spite of the fact that the comment was perfectly logical, it won Rumsfeld the 2003 Foot-in-Mouth Prize for the most baffling comment by a public figure. Returning to Meno's apparent puzzle, Socrates chose to reply with an even more bewildering statement, which has become known as Meno's paradox. "I know, Meno, what you mean, but just see what an heuristic, debatable argument you are introducing, that it is impossible for someone to inquire into what he knows or does not know. He wouldn't inquire into what he knows, since he already knows it, and there is no need for such a person to inquire, nor into what he doesn't know, because he doesn't know what he is going to inquire into." One can paraphrase the last part of Socrates' answer in terms of its application to curiosity, to argue, "She wouldn't be curious about what she knows, since she already knows it, nor about what she doesn't know, because she doesn't know what she should be curious about." Does this mean that we can never be curious? Absolutely not, and this is why Meno's paradox isn't really a paradox. As far as I know, modern psychologists do not, at least not routinely, refer to Plato's Meno. Still, some of them do use a somewhat similar argument to propose that if we examine how our level of curiosity in a particular topic is affected by our existing knowledge in that subject, we would find a function that looks like an inverted U. See figure 14 in the accompanying PDF. Simply put, it is very difficult to become curious about something when you know very little about it. Similarly, when you know a lot about a certain topic, you may feel that there is nothing more to be curious about. However, our curiosity is truly piqued when we already have some information about a subject, but we feel that there is still more to be learned. In his provocative answer, Socrates simply omitted that all-important intermediate range of knowledge, what you might call the known unknowns, things you know or sense that you don't know. One version of the inverted U-curve, figure 15 in the PDF, dates all the way back to Wilhelm Wundt, who in the late 19th century was one of the founding figures of psychology. Wundt suggested that as the intensity of a stimulus increases, positive arousal increases too, but only up to a point. For more intense stimuli, the experience starts to become too overwhelming, resulting in a decrease in the positive response. The arousal eventually becomes negative. In the 1970s, Berlein proposed that Wundt's curve really represents the interaction of two separate brain functions. One encourages curiosity and exploratory behavior through a reward mechanism, and the other cautions against it by creating an unpleasant sensation. Berlein's idea can be schematically rendered, as in figure 16 in the accompanying PDF. According to this model, the positive reward mechanism, represented by the upper curve in the figure, acts in such a way that up to a certain level, the more surprising or confounding the phenomenon we observe, the more curious we become. At some point, however, our curiosity saturates, and no matter how much more complex, novel, or puzzling the phenomenon may be, we don't become any more curious. Our curiosity levels off, corresponding to the flat part of the upper curve. In Berline's interpretation, the aversive negative system, represented by the lower curve in the figure, kicks in only at a higher level of prompt intensity, when the stimulus appears threatening or evokes fear. For any stronger stimuli, the negative feelings continuously increase, corresponding to the negative curve dipping lower in Figure 16. Berline suggested that the Wundt curve is simply a consequence of the brain cognitively summing up the positive and negative contributions of the two systems. That is, for as long as the distressing reaction is not activated, curiosity increases as the incentive becomes stronger. Once the brain inwardly starts to weigh the potential negative effects, curiosity starts diminishing, hence producing the inverted U-shape in Figure 15 in the PDF. We can understand Berline's concept using a simple metaphor. Imagine that you are traveling through Yellowstone National Park and you suddenly spot a grizzly bear in the distance. This would undoubtedly raise curiosity and excitement. Then, next to the first grizzly, you spot a female grizzly bear with her cub. This new discovery generates even more curiosity. Soon thereafter, an entire swath of grizzly bears comes into view in the same area, stimulating an even higher degree of curiosity, especially because bears tend to be solitary animals. But not only doesn't the appearance of more grizzly bears evoke curiosity, fear starts to set in. So many grizzlies in one place is alarming. The concern and fear are further enhanced as more grizzly bears show up nearby. You may have noticed that Berline's version of the cognitive response corresponds almost precisely to the mixture of desire for exploration and fear that Leonardo expressed at the entrance to the cave he discovered in the mountains. Berline's explanation for the inverted U curve introduced a new element into the theory of curiosity, a positive reward system. Interestingly, even though Berline's ideas had been presented prior to, and in fact largely inspired the information gap theory, that theory still associated curiosity primarily with the need to reduce a negative emotion, with a relatively small and essentially insignificant role for positive consciousness. While Lowenstein recognized that exploratory behavior may also be motivated by a positive interest rather than a feeling of deprivation, his information gap model implicitly implied that the positive desire for knowledge by itself does not constitute curiosity per se. However, as we shall see in the next chapter, other researchers view curiosity as motivated for its own sake and not just as a vehicle for reducing an unpleasant sensation. In spite of its thought-provoking attributes, Berline's explanation for the Wundt curve has also proved somewhat controversial. First, the interpretation requires the near coexistence of intense antagonistic emotions, pleasure and fear. Opinions vary on whether such a situation is possible, but most psychologists agree that Berline's notion that a positive affect should precede the negative one is implausible. For his description to work as conceived, Berline had to assume that pleasure is an almost necessary step on the way to a disagreeable state, since aversion kicks in after the positive reward system at a higher stimulus level, as shown in Figure 16 in the PDF. At least in the case of the emotion of fear, which has been extensively studied by Joseph Ledoux, there is no evidence for the reward system being activated before fear is felt. In addition, at the quantitative level, Berline did not provide any compelling explanation for either the relative strengths of the positive and negative emotions, or the assumed timing of their activation. Nevertheless, the mere fact that Berline considered the possibility that curiosity incorporates both a pleasurable and a discomforting component was significant for the progress in understanding curiosity. This was the seed for the idea that curiosity may consist of a family of mechanisms, which I shall discuss in detail in the next chapter. As I noted earlier, the information gap theory raises its own set of difficulties when regarded as a comprehensive theory of curiosity. In addition to the potentially serious problem of identifying curiosity solely with an unpleasant state, the information gap theory appears, at least at first blush, to fail to explain the common inverted U pattern. If curiosity is assumed always to intensify with increasing uncertainty, then as we move to higher and higher uncertainty levels, there is no value of uncertainty at which curiosity should start to wane, eventually leading to boredom or even anxiety. In other words, there is no inverted U curve. This particular aspect, however, has been easily remedied with a relatively straightforward modification to the initial concept. Not all subjectively inconsistent observations, not all uncertainties, doubts, or values of the information gap lead to curiosity. If the gap between what is thought to be known and what is observed is very small, the disparity would not seem, at least in some cases, sufficient for us even to bother with, let alone be curious about. If, on the other hand, the gap is enormous, high levels of doubtfulness or conflict that may lead to confusion and anxiety, and instead of generating curiosity, the gap may be deemed impossible to close. In this interpretation, only an intermediate level of uncertainty can create and sustain curiosity. Put differently, we are not particularly interested in subjects about which we know almost everything, or practically nothing. We tend to be interested when we know quite a bit, but feel that there is more to be learned. Known unknowns. With this simple supplement, the information gap model accounts for an inverted U function. As I shall describe in detail in Chapter 6, the expectation, consistent with the information gap model and the inverted U shape, that a moderate amount of information increases curiosity, but that much additional information reduces it, has received support from an interesting neuroscientific experiment. In spite of its undeniable successes with some aspects of curiosity, the remaining problems with the information gap model, even when complemented by the inverted U characteristic, have motivated researchers to turn to different ideas. In an attempt to find other explanations for curiosity, cognitive scientists started to explore the notion that curiosity itself is rewarding, and that it is driven by the search for the pleasurable effects of wonder and interest rather than by the unpleasant ones of deprivation and absence of knowledge. Chapter 5. Curious about curiosity. Intrinsic love of knowledge. If curiosity is not a means to reduce the unpleasantness associated with uncertainty, or at least not only that, what or what else is it? Recent research in psychology suggests that curiosity may provide its own reward. That is, curiosity may be a powerful source of motivation for its own sake, intrinsic motivation, with no control from any external or internal pressure, and with no apparent reward except for the activity itself. The mind, according to this view, should be able to produce rewards that assign value to information gathering and to the acquisition of knowledge. This perspective has its roots in work done at the beginning of the 20th century by such psychological pioneers as J. Clark Murray and John Dewey. The concept is based on the simple observation that seeking novel stimuli, interesting people, and new unexpected ideas appears to be a defining characteristic of being human. Can you even imagine a world without exploration of our external universe and our internal self? Of the microcosm and the macrocosm? Leonardo and Feynman certainly couldn't. In fact, in the same year that Lowenstein published his influential information gap model, psychologists Charles Spielberger and Laura Starr proposed an optimal stimulation dual process scenario. In their theory, which, like Lowenstein's framework, incorporated a few of Berline's earlier ideas. Optimal arousal is achieved as a result of two competing processes. Novel, complex, or incongruent phenomena arouse both a state of curiosity that is perceived as pleasant and an anxiety that is aversive. Spielberger and Starr suggest that when the intensity of the external triggering stimulus is low, curiosity dominates, along with a desire to explore. At moderate levels of incentive intensity, the fusion of high, pleasant curiosity and moderate, unpleasant anxiety tends to trigger specific exploration, that is, a search for distinct pieces of information. Finally, for very powerful stimuli, when we see something that is totally unexpected or extremely confusing, the level of anxiety becomes so high that it motivates total avoidance rather than exploration. The Spielberger and Starr model reintroduced, following Berline, the idea that curiosity can be conceptualized as a positive feeling of interest and wonder. Anyone who ever watched a child with her eyes gleaming as an amateur magician demonstrates his tricks can at least sympathize with this point of view. Adopting a position that was, in some sense, diametrically opposed to that of Lowenstein, Spielberger and Starr identified the unpleasant state caused by uncertainty as anxiety rather than curiosity. Lowenstein, you will recall, suggests that curiosity acts only to alleviate the discomfort associated with an information gap. His model implies that information-seeking motivated just by pure interest should not be labeled curiosity. Simply put, whereas to Lowenstein, curiosity is like scratching an itch to relieve it, and the love of learning is something else, to Spielberger and Starr, curiosity is the thirst for knowledge, while ambivalence causes anxiety, not curiosity. The important point, however, is that both hypotheses can be put to experimental tests. As you might expect, Spielberger and Starr's optimal arousal model also leaves a few questions unanswered. The problem is with there being an optimal arousal state, which implies that this is a desirable condition to be in. However, if such a state exists, it is not clear why anyone would want to have his or her inquiries, mysteries, and puzzles resolved if that would reduce the positive experience of curiosity to a level of arousal that is less than optimal. Precisely to avoid these types of problems, and at the same time to incorporate several, sometimes conflicting, ideas into one comprehensive model, psychologist Jordan Littman of the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition proposed in 2005 that curiosity has two aspects. One, which Littman dubbed I-curiosity, represents the interest, hence the I, and striving for knowledge that involves pleasurable emotional experiences, while the other, D-curiosity, results from the feeling of uncertainty and deprivation, hence the D, associated with not having access to certain information. I should emphasize that Littman's model is not meant to represent a way to hedge one's bets. He correctly points out that many motivational systems can involve, under different circumstances, both pleasant and unpleasant emotions. For instance, hunger may be stimulated by watching a TV commercial for Doritos or films such as Babette's Feast, Mostly Martha, or Julie and Julia, which are all celebrations of exquisite cuisine. Alternatively, you may realize that you're hungry from the pangs caused by an empty stomach or the desire to pamper yourself when you feel neglected. Similarly, the desire to engage in sex may be sparked by a spontaneous, pleasant emotion toward a loved partner or by the deprivation induced by a long absence, such as military service in a foreign country. To put it differently, according to Littman's conjecture, curiosity may be both a reduction of an aversive state and an induction of an intrinsically motivated, enjoyable state. Which one dominates will depend on the type of stimulus and perhaps on individual differences. For instance, the beating of the human heart, which triggered a torrent of epistemic curiosity, the drive to explore in Leonardo, and caused him to fill innumerable pages with notes hardly even registered with many of his contemporaries. Similarly, not remembering the names of the students who sat next to them in high school may drive some people crazy and leave others totally indifferent. Or seeing an unfamiliar animal in a zoo may evoke perceptual curiosity in some visitors. They will look for the placard identifying the animal, and epistemic curiosity in a few others. They will extensively read about it at home. This general idea of curiosity comprising a family of mechanisms rather than representing a single process has been further examined by a team of researchers led by Jacqueline Gottlieb of Columbia University, Celeste Kidd of the University of Rochester, and Pierre-Yves Oudier of the French Institute for Research in Computer Science and Automation. They suggest that the weight we assign to the different components and forms of curiosity depends on both the stimulating event or topic and the individuals themselves, in terms of their knowledge base, biases, and cognitive characteristics. As we shall see in Chapter 6, recent results from neuroscience support a scenario in which different kinds of curiosity involve distinct brain regions. As I have pointed out, individual differences in curiosity can be enormous. Whereas Leonardo and Feynman, for instance, were curious about almost everything, some people have very few interests outside their work. These differences have traditionally been studied largely in the context of a general trait labeled openness to experience, considered one of the big five dimensions of human personality. In psychology, those big five personality attributes are openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, forming the acronym OCEAN. Of these five characteristics, openness to experience is the one that is assumed to encompass intellectual curiosity and preference for novelty and exploration, even though the precise definition of openness is somewhat controversial. Broadly speaking, people with high openness are not only more curious but also more appreciative of such things as complex forms of art. They have a higher capacity to think in abstract terms. Even if we accept the very reasonable idea that curiosity, in all of its different manifestations, involves both a deprivation induced by uncertainty and an anticipation of rewards stimulated by an intrinsic striving for knowledge, many things remain unknown. How exactly does the brain put value on knowledge and on its acquisition? What is the mental strategy, if there is one, that underlies information seeking and exploration? We know, for instance, that the white noise on a TV screen, when there is no transmission, contains a vast amount of information. Yet I am not aware of anybody who is riveted by those flickering points of light and accompanying hissing noises. What is the process in which the human mind sifts through all the information that bombards us and decides what to be curious about? Cognitive scientists are trying to understand whether curiosity-induced behavior has any strategic plan or ultimate goals. Explore all options. Both everyday experience and numerous studies demonstrate that individuals engage in exploratory behavior,